It is Saturday, November 15th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news and your calls and questions about technology.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, we have birthday boy Ben Jaffe, freelance media dude. Morning, Ben.
Woohoo.
Hey, Ben, you made a wonderful video for us. I don't know if you did that to promote your personal business or just because you love us, but
I love you guys.
We have a great, at the end of today's show, once we get the show page up, we have a great behind the scenes video that Ben produced. Thank you so much, Ben. And Ben's available, I'm assuming, for that kind of work anywhere, right?
Yeah,
all right.
Video.
Ben Jaffe. And we also have Miles Elam. Miles Elam is a student, programmer, and political junkie. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And now, Miles, you were just accepted to UCSC to finish your bachelor's degree.
Yeah, re-accepted, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when you actually were at UCSC originally, Ben was, what, 4? I think that was... No. In any case, you're going to be doing literature program?
Yeah, actually, I was doing the math real quick. He was 7.
He was 7. Okay, yeah. That fits.
Was
so,
I?
When yeah. Ben was first, when Miles was first in college, you were 7 years old.
That's I all. Was. Okay. Well, never mind.
Miles, you're going to be working for the next year on your bachelor's degree in literature major, and then you're going to be working on, well, you're not exactly
a teacher's
sure,
credential.
Teacher's
yeah.
credential. All right. And we also have Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager at Vidya. Morning, Sean.
Good morning.
And we're going to be doing the geek news today. In the second half, we'll be taking calls with questions and comments about technology. But for the first half, the news. Mr. Miles Elam, good morning.
It's been a rough week for those spammers.
Aww.
First,
smallest violin playing here.
Right. First, the ISP, Internet Service Provider, that was responsible for facilitating more than 75% of all junk email was taken off the air.
Wait, so the 75% of the spammers were just taken out?
So of their primary conduit through, yeah.
Wow. Basically, was that for Ben's birthday? That's pretty magical.
McCullough Corp. It's a San Jose-based web hosting service. The client list included some of the most disreputable cyber gangs in business today. And it's been a long time coming. And we have Brian Krebs from Security Fix, the blog from Washington Post, to thank for it. He was spearheading that effort to get them off the air.
A public figure.
A public figure.
When you say cyber, what do you say? Cyber crimes?
Cyber crimes.
Just sounds like someone with a mohawk. I mean, that's all there is to it.
But in addition to that,
yeah, so it's not just spam. I mean, spam, is spam considered a crime? I wouldn't consider that necessarily a crime, but they were also involved in this whole putting malware in your machine.
On the contrary, there's a great deal of fraud involved with the online pharmaceutical spam that you get. There's a lot of fraud associated with that. People selling placebo pills, people selling things that are of questionable quality. And you also have the Nigerian scam coming through, which recently in the news, a woman was hit with a $400,000, you know, fraud case. Or rather, she lost $400,000.
How did she have $400,000 and think it was a good idea to start giving away? I mean, how did she get all that money?
Well, for this woman, it's, and for people like her, a lot of them, you get the email
savings.
About, you know, I am a Nigerian prince and I'm trying to get this money out. And there's a sense of camaraderie or I need to help this person. And so that combined with a not insignificant portion of greed of
I get the motivation for doing it. I understand how they play on people's desires and such, but and how they socially engineer a victim. But how does this victim have $400,000 if it's so easy for them to be socially engineered?
She basically exhausted her husband's retirement fund. She remortgaged her already paid for house and also put a lien on her car. Okay. Things like that. So
totally major, taxed out her retirement and her husband's retirement.
Right.
That is really sad. Okay, so, but some of these spam vehicles have just gone away. 75% of spam
has
just gone
away. Well, the main conduit.
Are we going to see a drop in spam, a severe drop in spam?
For the short term, yes.
Wow, that's great.
But there's always going to be other people that want – I mean, there's a huge amount of money involved here. So there's going to be another ISP, someone setting up saying, like, yeah, I'll take that money. I don't care.
Right.
So it's going to be a whack-a-mole type of thing. You know, one head gets knocked down, another one pops back up again, and we continue the whole thing.
Whack-a-mole.
Thank you, Miles. Hey, Sean. Good morning.
That's a good analogy, whack-a-mole.
Yeah, so that's what spam feels like, that's for sure.
Good morning. We always get that spam message, just gobbledygook, the header and all kind of junk inside.
Through our web interface?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of frustrating.
Every now and then. It's not a bunch of them, just we get it every few days.
Well, yeah, they don't have any feedback to know that we're getting them or not getting them, so there's no real incentive. And we never respond to them. We never actually click on
the link.
So
if one of us responded, we'd probably get a flood of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway... this is a new story for Lyle. I think you would really like this.
Mm-hmm.
Industrial motors, you know, spin at about 250,000 revolutions per minute.
Sure.
Planets, when they're really old and they've collapsed, they spin at around 60,000 RPM. And they don't.
Wait, a planet?
Yeah, a planet does. But it spins about 60,000 RPM when it collapses on itself. Think of a figure skater when they pull their arms in and they spin faster.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Wait, a planet or a star?
Stars.
Planets don't collapse on themselves,
A star.
Right.
A star. So, and when it does, they don't think they could spin much faster than 60,000 RPM. They would just spin apart.
Right.
So, researchers at ETH Zurich's Department of Power Electronics have devised a drive system. How many RPMs do you think they achieve?
What's the drive system for? Oh, just to test speeds?
Well, actually, there are real applications for motors that can spin at high speeds. Think about cell phones. The smaller they get, the smaller the holes need to be for the wires. So you need a really high-speed drill to do that. You know, there's a lot of applications.
I'll guess 1 million RPM.
It's because you're reading off my screen.
No. You're kidding me.
No, seriously, 1 million RPM.
A million revolutions per minute.
Yes.
That's really, really fast. How big is this thing?
It's actually matchbox size. It's really small. And it uses a titanium shell to withstand, flying apart. It uses ultra-thin copper wire for the windings. And it uses it's all inserted in a cylinder made of special iron previously unused for machines. So no one really knows what it is, just top secret.
So what do you do with this thing? I mean, you're not going to drill stuff with that. That's ridiculous.
They say it can be.
Any kind of flaw in the shaft, and it's going to
be. Well, maybe at that speed, but still, half that speed is still amazing, right?
That's really cool. A million revolutions per minute. Wow.
So, compact compressors for airplanes and cars, more efficient and faster drills. Yeah, a lot of different things.
Very cool.
Kind of interesting. A million RPMs.
Almost completely unbelievable. What university is it?
It's from ETH Zurich's Department of Power and Electronics.
Wow. Very cool. Thanks, Sean.
Yeah.
I like technology. Ben.
Yeah, it is fun sometimes. So some regular listeners will remember back on May 24th when we were talking about infrasound and ultrasound. Well, I found a very interesting story that relates to this. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, they are putting these new sirens on their fleet of ambulances. And they work on the basis of sending out really low tones that can penetrate through vehicles and things like that, and that people can actually feel, maybe vibrate or, make ripples in a cup of water, as opposed to just the loud sounds, because, people have really expensive audio systems and, they've mm-hmm. got those cranked up loud, or their attention is on their cell phone or texting or trying to fumble with their Bluetooth headset or something. And there are a lot of accidents between ambulances, which are, obviously have the right of way. But if you're not paying attention, then, you could run into one. And so the idea is that this low frequency siren can prevent accidents because people will actually feel it as opposed to just hearing the higher pitch. And
interesting idea.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty cool. And there, it's actually not infrasound, because if you remember in May, we were talking about infrasound, like below 20 hertz, where we can't hear it specifically, but we can feel it, or it'll mess with our
body systems.
Body systems, mm-hmm. Yeah. But this is actually not that low. But it took some. I'm kind of disappointed that the Associated Press didn't give all that much information on how it worked.
How low is it? What frequency is it?
But it's not a frequency. It actually cuts the frequency of the actual siren that's already mounted to the vehicle in half or a quarter of that, and it sends out that tone. So
it matches the siren sound in its modulation pattern, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Except it's two octaves lower.
Right. Right. So it's just going down to the frequency where, you know, like a rumbling truck or motorcycle sound level.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Something like that. And of course, lower sounds will penetrate through objects
more easily. The car a little bit more.
Exactly. Right. Whereas high sounds will travel further, but they can be stopped much more easily.
And like a luxury car, you're not going to get high frequency sounds or, you know, voice level frequency sounds going through.
It's amazing what they've done with
it. It makes sense to have a siren going the as much spectrum width as possible, right?
To
announce yourself all across the spectrum.
Definitely. Definitely.
All right. Well, thanks, Ben, for that. Yeah. Miles, your story.
So researchers have created artificial diamonds already through a process called carbon vapor deposition. It's one of the primary ways of doing
it. Last week we were talking about diamonds out of...
Tequila.
Tequila, yeah.
Tequila, but, right. Mm-hmm. And so this is, right now you're already seeing artificial diamonds for sale as gem diamonds. Mm-hmm. But they're relatively small. They tend to be a maximum of, say, a centimeter by a centimeter. I mean...
What size carat is that? That's pretty big carat, isn't it? Well, in any case,
traditionally
it's been small.
Yeah, so far the largest from carbon vapor deposition, the current way, is a 34-carat yellow diamond. So it's about a cubic centimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with this is that once you make that diamond, it's going to be a brownish tint, and you have to put it into this high-temperature, very costly machine to basically cook out or burn out the impurities in a process known as annealing.
Oh, which actually makes a clear diamond.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or makes it clearer.
Right.
But yeah. However, some groups at the Carnegie Institute, or a group at the Carnegie Institute of Washington, have discovered a way of annealing a diamond, a raw carbon vapor deposition diamond, using microwaves. And they're raising the temperature of the chamber to approximately 2,200 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm. It's hot.
But with a relatively low corresponding pressure.
Okay.
So they don't have to have quite as costly a process. It's just making it hot and keeping it somewhat contained.
So first you do the high pressure thing, which produces kind of a yellowy-brown diamond, and then you put it in this microwave thing, which clears it?
Actually, the carbon vapor deposition doesn't require the high pressure. The high pressure is to clear the diamond.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And
so when you create the diamond, you're doing a vapor, letting it crystallize like you would put sugar into water and let it crystallize around an element.
Or you might think of it in terms of would be frost.
Right.
You have condensation in the air or water vapor in the air. If it's cold enough, it'll deposit directly as an ice or frost onto the ground. You're doing the same thing only with carbon on a seed.
So how do we make a big diamond?
So with this process, you don't need a tight, you know, small high-pressure chamber. You can do it on a low pressure, and therefore the scale allows for it to be larger. So they're talking about kilocarat diamonds at this point.
So like 1,000 soccer carats. Balls kind of thing.
Yeah, huge ones. And the only limitation...
Diamond processors, here we come.
Right, yes. But the only limitation is the size of your industrial microwave oven. If you can make a larger microwave oven, you can make a larger diamond.
That's what I'm talking about. So, wow. So diamond age, here we come. Very cool.
Right. Now, how are you going to, you know, wear a soccer ball around your neck, you know, at a ball?
I'm sure there are some hip-hop artists who would do it.
But one, this is going to reduce the prices of diamonds tremendously, especially the artificial ones for gems. But it will also make the field available for computers,
mm-hmm.
because diamonds are also great heat sinks. that if you had a wafer-thin diamond and you press it between your hands, press it between your fingers, it's going to absorb the heat that's in your fingers, in your hand. And you could use that wafer to cut through a piece of ice, you know, very quickly, like a hot knife through butter, because all that heat is then immediately shot out into the ice again.
Hmm. So diamond as tools, we might start seeing that like more frequently.
Oh, what about diamond-headed... You know, drill bits. And, sure. I mean, right now we're using diamond.
But when that's a diamond powder that's been put onto the drill bit.
Right, but it doesn't have to be.
So, yeah, now you're going to be talking. Well, I don't know if you will, because diamond
you're
has
going to want a steel structure behind it.
Yeah, diamond's going to have more of a shattering.
Yeah, but the processors tendency. Definitely wafers.
Yeah, well, it's just
substrate.
The use of synthetic diamonds can for industrial uses and even for computing. I mean, there's a lot of ways that they can use these things. Instead of selling them on the market to put on fingers,
right.
You know.
But they've always been this really small, these really small items, and they've been cheaper than natural diamonds, but not so much so that you go like, oh, okay, let's completely drop natural diamonds.
Right, right.
Now you're getting to the point where these diamonds, which can be made of higher quality than the ones you find in nature, that are a perfect crystal structure for all intents and purposes, are now, you can have a nice big chunk.
Right.
And then cut it up as many pieces as you want, or don't cut it up. Or
very cool. Miles, thank you for that story about diamonds, the diamond age emerging. Sean? Oh, nice. Actually, first off, we're talking with Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is Sean Cleveland.
Hi.
Nice.
Well said.
By the way, I can't get on Amiibo today, guys.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah,
we
I'm
miss
still
you.
Trying. I'm working on
it. It looks like Rick can either. I don't see him.
I can't either.
Maybe that is Rick as the guest. Anyway, no one cares about this.
No, no one cares about that. Let's go.
Intel kind of made a shocking announcement last week. I'm sorry about my voice. I've been sick. I just can't seem to get my voice back.
It's really bothering me.
Yeah. Okay, no, I'll stop talking. So Intel announced that their revenue is going to be cut by $1.1 billion in the next quarter. That's kind of big.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, when Intel makes a prediction like that, or, you know, makes So let's get – they just announced that they had one of the healthiest quarters in their history. They actually pulled in $10.3 billion. That's 59% gross margin over the last quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big jump over the quarter of the same quarter last year.
So this is
and
last,
everybody thought,
last
you know, this is – wow, Intel's making a lot of money. But they announced that their next quarter was going to be lower than they expected. And now they just came out and said, oh, it's actually going to be lower than we thought.
Wow.
So that's, you know, so it's not good.
Lower by a billion and a half, do you say?
1.1 billion.
Whoa. What is their total revenue? Like how much of a percentage drop is that?
So fourth quarter of last year saw Intel rake in about $10.7 billion, which is 58% margin. And now they've said that it's only going to be around $9 billion.
Right. So we're talking about a 10% decrease.
Yeah. And they're attributing it to significantly weaker than expected demand in all geographies and market segments.
Oh, man.
And a PC supply chain that's aggressively reducing component inventories. So this is affecting everybody. And, right. Of course, the stocks and all the tech stocks just dropped drastically this week.
Something I do wonder about, though, with their Atom processors going toward the mobile market and low power market, that's a whole separate thing. But how long ago did we hit the point where a CPU was fast enough for a lot of people, how they use their
computers? You know, we think of Intel as a CPU company, but it's only a partial of what it does. It's across the market. So,
well, CPUs is by far where they make the most of their money.
Well,
their
margins are so good because of those. But I would assume that that's not the 50% of their market share. But
I'm pretty sure this is the majority, yeah.
This is everything. I mean, this is hitting them across the board.
Yeah, but the majority of the money they make is from CPUs.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
So, Miles, what you're asking is the processor fast enough? Why do we need to do faster processors?
No, I don't mean that. I mean in terms of what the market would bear. In the past, it was very clear, like, this is a much faster CPU. This is going to make a much faster computer. Now,
it's not much faster. It's about 10 to 15% faster. And the thing is you can buy a Core 2 right now, you know, for $150. And, oh, my God, that's so much performance. You know?
Right, that's what I mean.
Yeah, it's exactly, you're hitting it right on the head.
Right, when someone had a 46 and you went to a Pentium, that was a huge jump. When you went from a Pentium to a Pentium 2, that was a huge jump.
Even when you went from a Pentium 4 to a Core 2, that was a huge jump. the Core 2 to this new CPU, not so huge. I mean, if you're a hardcore gamer and you're running multiple video cards, yeah, that's a big jump. Otherwise, you have a Core 2 now.
Sean, but do you think the processor difference or the limited quality of the processor increase, whatever, is the reason for this downturn for Intel? Or do you think it's...
No, I think it has more to do with the economy, and people are tightening up their belts. I just don't think you're going to see a lot of big computer purchases this year. It'll be probably $400 or $500 PCs. And these aren't the high-end stuff.
Right. And all the vendors out there are going, how can I make a cheap computer and not have a high inventory? Right. And, of course, that doesn't mean buying the newest from Intel. So it's really about the whole supply chain just slowing down.
Yeah.
Which is pretty bad. And I'm assuming that's happening in multiple sectors, not just the tech sector.
Yeah. People need to upgrade. I'm sure of it. And you can if you've... Right now, you can
now's
get
the time,
great
I
deals
guess, yeah.
on computers. And if you get a Core 2 CPU... you're getting a great system.
Yeah, but you're just talking about board and memory too when you do that. I mean, it's pretty much a big upgrade for Core 2.
Yeah, but when people buy new system, they're usually targeting a CPU and then everything else in that system, of course, comes from other companies.
Right.
And
okay, so
that's going to affect the market.
You said that in general, when Intel released this really bad earnings, that other markets got hit hard.
Well, they released great earnings, but they just readjusted their fourth quarter earnings outlook, their projection. Down by 1.1 billion.
And that affected all tech.
And everybody saw that this holiday season maybe isn't going to be so great. If Intel is expecting the forecast to be much lower, that it's going to affect, 10% of their business, then yeah, that's huge.
Right. If the CPU isn't going to be there, then all the components that connect to that CPU aren't going to be there.
What are some other examples of downturns in the tech industry right now? Sun did some layoffs yesterday.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they did laid off 15 to 18% of their workforce.
Oh, man. And what about like AMD, like a pretty direct
Well, AMD
is
Intel. Not doing well at all. They're $2.43
a share.
Their market cap is 1.4 something billion.
Right.
They bought ATI a few years ago at 5 billion.
Right. Oh, man.
So
things aren't good in the tech industry for that. But now
you can look at any tech company
right
now.
This could be really good for consumers. You're going to be able to get a nice computer for
Google
cheap.
Dropped below $300.
It's just ridiculous that they're at $300 in the first place. Oh, man. All right, let's go on to the next news story. Thank you very much, Sean. Oh, actually, we need to take a little bit of a business break. This morning, the geeks are Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the geeks are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 831-476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And we have people calling in right away. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello, my name is Mike from Hollywood, Maryland. How are you?
Quite well, Mike. What's your question today?
I listened to your show via podcast, and I was actually getting excited about this Linux Ubuntu you talk a lot about. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'd be snazzy and put it on my Windows XP machine last night, but I think I erased the hard drive with all the Windows stuff on it. So,
oh, no.
Oh, oh no.
Yeah. So I was looking for a recommendation for a decent data recovery application to see if I can get some of those documents filed back.
Wait, let's first figure out if you really erased it. I think that would be extremely hard to do without really being conscious of doing it. Miles, would you agree with that?
Did you double-click the install icon?
And actually got Ubuntu installed. I think perhaps where I made a mistake was when it asked about partitioning the disk. There were two options. One was manual and one was automatic, I think it said. And I clicked automatic and it just went.
No, that should be it would be very strange for me. Ubuntu is very good about trying to be friendly with Windows. That's kind of their goal, is that you can try Ubuntu out and stuff and not destroy your operating system. So just out of curiosity, when you boot up your computer at this time, do you see any menu at all?
No, it just goes straight to Ubuntu.
Well, it would do that over a timeout. I mean, one way or another, you should still see a grub menu when you first boot
up. It's a little boot menu that talks about what it's doing. Do you see that?
I do see. I remember seeing the word grub on the screen. I don't remember there being an option like, number one, if you want to go to Windows, number two, if you want to go to Ubuntu.
It would be an arrow up or down, most likely. Mm-hmm.
Well, the other thing is when he's in Ubuntu, he'd be able to see his Windows partition. Did you download the live CD?
Yeah, I did. And then from the live CD, I went ahead, tried it a few times, and it looked neat. And listened to a podcast of yours yesterday, and you talked a lot about Ubuntu, so I said I'm going to go ahead and do this. and I went and did it. I downloaded some sort of partition application off of CNET,
mm-hmm.
and built a CD from that and booted that up. And all it showed was a single partition in Windows, on the hard drive. It didn't show two partitions. Would it normally show two partitions if
that,
it would have?
That seems odd to me as well, because Ubuntu would have made a swap partition. If you told it automatic, you should have at least two partitions on there.
Okay, well, it's possible.
Okay, so the question, so let's assume that you did what you fear you did, and then you erased your Windows partition. Is there a recovery tool to fix this?
Yes.
I would say the answer to recovering completely and actually being back in Windows again like you were before, not easily in any way. But if you were trying to just get files that you think you erased that you really want, like JPEGs and things of that nature, then possibly. But basically, this is kind of a worst case scenario.
And I know I went again on CNET. I mm-hmm. found an application called Virtual Lab Data Recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to be well-rated. I wondered if you guys had a suggestion.
Yeah, what you want to do at this point is go down and buy a hard drive. They're not very expensive.
Okay.
Get a SATA hard drive. Take your hard drive that's in your computer right now and take it out. Put the SATA hard drive in. Install Windows on it. And you could do this all in Linux instead, but I think doing it in Windows instead is good. Install Windows on it. Get the machine running with Windows. Then take that SATA drive that you have and plug it into another SATA port. And boot up, and what will happen is your machine will boot up in the Windows that you just installed, and then start using the recovery disks on tools on that other disk, and see where you can go from there. But just make sure to get another hard drive as your primary drive, because as you use the current drive you're using, you're erasing data and losing data as you go.
Got it,
Mike. Thank you so much. I'm so sorry that you had this dilemma. For everyone out there, this is a good learning experience, I guess. If you're going to try Ubuntu, don't click through the automatic.
Actually, even if you're not going to try Ubuntu, make sure you make backups.
Yeah, I guess that's a good
sure.
thing.
Yeah.
Mike, let us know through email and stuff, too. I'd like to hear how the story goes.
Sure, thanks for the help.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I feel partially responsible. I don't know about you guys.
If you're going to try, maybe do the CD.
He played with the live CD and liked Ubuntu and decided to go forward. And really, it's about moving your data off, and then you'll be okay. I've never seen this experience happen of someone erasing their entire Windows partition.
Yeah, whenever I've seen that, it resizes a partition and installs.
Right. That's why I think it really is still there, and it's just some kind of menu choice.
Something else, hard drives are so inexpensive.
Right, and you can do two hard drives in your system. Have Ubuntu on one and have Windows on the other.
You could literally go buy a 200 gig drive for probably $20, $30.
Something like that.
It's ridiculous. And throw it in and do it that way.
We're taking calls with comments and questions about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. We're now going to Pacific Grove. Gene, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Well, thank you, guys. Let me give you a quick background on my spam question.
Okay.
In last April, I got a Mac. I got rid of, I didn't get rid of, I still got the old machine. And I switched ISPs because I got a deal from SBC when I bought the Mac. And my old ISP was CompuServe. So the old machine's still here, not online, and I still go, and I haven't taken CompuServe off, so I still go look at it occasionally, and I couldn't get it through SBC, and you guys recommended I
remember
installed Firefox.
Sure.
That worked. That lets me in. Now, remember if you remember, I'm one of those people who didn't have, virus protection.
Mm-hmm.
My virus protection is if it looks suspicious, I go to my friendly library and I open it there. Well, what happened recently, remember the old machine's not online,
uh-huh.
and I went downtown, opened up one, well, actually, I saw it here, and then I haven't opened it. I got spam from myself.
Yeah.
Because that happened?
Yeah.
And if I open, my question is then, if I opened the spam from and my old machine hasn't been used since last April, if I opened my spam downtown at the library, would I be able to tell where the damn spam came from? Do anything about
it? You can kind of. So here's the thing. Here's the thing with when spam from yourself kind of thing. It doesn't mean your other machine is infected and sending spam. What's happened is your address is out in the wild west of spammers, and they have tools to send out mass mailing. And what they normally try to do is they try to use address books that, or try to have use email addresses that will be from another person in the email address that's similar. So one common thing they'll do is they'll look at like a Cruise.io or local ISP's domain names, and they'll say, well, I'll have one of these people send spam to all the other people that are in the same domain name, because that's probably they have a higher chance of looking at the spam because it's from someone that's kind of like their own email address. And so one thing that will happen sometimes is that you'll actually get a copy of a message being sent from, quote, yourself, but really it's just a spammer using your from email address. It's nothing, you can't really do anything about it. The frustrating one also is that when that stuff starts bouncing, you start getting notices saying messages of yours are bouncing because we don't know who this email address is. And you're like, I never sent that message. And that's why. It's nothing you can really do except, I mean, the only thing you can really do is change your email address frequently.
Yeah, gotcha. Huh? Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Gene. Bye-bye. Sean, what's up, man?
I want to do a news story.
Go for it.
So Obama's going to start delivering his weekly address via YouTube.
Nice.
How cool is that?
Before he becomes president or like right now?
Yeah, no. Supposedly on Thursday evening, they were going to do a YouTube video. They've already posted over 1,800 videos to their YouTube page.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So these new ones, I don't know when. No. It's supposed to be today. So it says that the videos will start being posted to change.gov, which is their new website.
Which we covered last week.
Yep, and via YouTube beginning today.
Well, that makes a lot of sense rather than putting on network television because, of course, on YouTube it's there forever. So even if you're not paying attention to news for a few weeks, you can look it up. And then it becomes this kind of archive of what the president's saying.
Yeah. It's also a lot cheaper for Obama.
Right, than buying network time.
And he's going to do audio too. So that's not getting lost. And other members of the administration are going to be posting their own videos as well.
It's great. You know, I got to say that this is a good way to run small businesses too, or large business, like a business of 400 employees or something. If you're answering a question, you seem to be answering it a lot, just put a video of yourself up. And the next time someone asks, how do I transfer from Eudora over to you, give them the URL of the video and say, if you need more help, let me know. Yeah. It saves time for everybody.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool. Thanks. All right, let's go ahead and go to, I think Watsonville would be nice. Judith, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Judith from Watsonville, and I have a question about a DVD, and it's sort of about an optical drive. It's usually on my computer, I can watch DVDs just fine, so I don't usually have a problem. But I got a two DVD set of a conference that has a number of different talks on it, and all of them. The first time I got it, all of them worked except this one talk, and it when it started playing the DVD, it shut my computer down. I mean, you could still see the screen, but it was stalled, and there was not even. I'm gonna have a Mac.
Do you hear kind of a sound of the drive going?
No, there's not really. It's just quiet.
And it sounds like it's really working hard to read the data. The disk is probably clean. It's brand new, right?
Well, it's brand new, but it was brand new, and it just stops. And the only thing I could do, I couldn't get Escape to come up, or the Force Quit to come up, or nothing. Nothing did anything, and so I just turned it off with pressing the.
So, here's two suggestions. What's happening is the software that's trying to read the DVD is getting caught in some kind of loop and tying up your processing time. So there's two solutions. One is don't put it in your Macintosh, put it in a DVD player. The other solution is don't use the DVD player that comes with the Mac. So there's actually a Mac application called iDVD. Is that what it's called? No, DVD player? DVD player.
DVD player, yeah.
And you can just not use that. And so when you stick your DVD in, that probably launches. Just quit it right away before it starts reading the disc.
Uh-huh.
And then you can go down, go get an application called VLC, which is called a Video LAN Player. This is available on Linux, Macintosh, and Windows.
VLC?
VLC. Video
VLC?
LAN. Video LAN Client. Thank you.
Video LAN Client. Okay,
yeah.
VLC.
Just do a search for VLC, all uppercase, one acronym, and you're going to find this app. Just download it for Macintosh. And what this thing does is it will play pretty much any video format. It's a kind of a universal player, and you can go full screen. And it might not crash the same way as your DVD player is doing. The only thing is you have to – it's kind of a geeky tool. You've got to go up to the open, and there's like three different open choices, and one is open disk. And if you choose open disk and then say okay, it'll open the DVD drive and start playing the movie.
It actually might ask you to locate your DVD drive. So just click on your DVD drive and then press open, and then it'll figure out.
Sometimes if you feel like software is thinking too much for you with VLC, you won't think that way. It's you've got to think more.
You've got to think a lot. Okay,
but try VLC. I like it a lot, and I use it all the time.
One other thing. Oh, sorry. Really quickly, one other thing is in your system preferences with CDs and DVDs, you can set it to not launch DVD player when you insert a video DVD.
I can choose which one.
can choose which one, or you can just say don't open anything, and that's actually what I prefer because I mean, sometimes if I'm burning a DVD or burning a CD, I don't want it to pop up and bother me.
I've never looked at the system preference menu. Thank you very much.
So it's the system preferences.
System preferences, CDs, and DVDs. Sean,
CDs
you had a point?
And DVDs. Oh, okay.
Yeah, these optical drives that are built into Macs, can you update the firmware on them? How does that work?
There are firmware updates sometimes for them. What you want to do is take a look at your model number and then go up to Apple's site. And it doesn't always do the auto up, like the auto software update doesn't always do the drivers things. When we had USB problems, I think, a while ago on the older
You probably don't need to worry about
problems.
Drivers. But the firmware adds support for new types of disk, types of disks. So definitely get that if you can.
The other possibility is that this disk is just not going to play anywhere.
Well, it's interesting. They said they would replace it, and they sent me another one, and it does exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
So could it be in the coding of the...
Yeah, it could be the way that it created the disk.
That particular disk,
there's either the way that they created the data that's on the disk, or the way the disk was created physically.
Yeah.
And if it's a disk created physically, the second one probably wouldn't have had that fault. But since it's the same thing happening, it's probably the content in the disk, and they probably just didn't test it on the Macintosh.
I'm sorry, who made this disk again?
It was a conference. It was a medical type conference, so it was I don't know what the name of the company is, but it's
Try it on another DVD player too, just like a commercial DVD player.
Also possible that there's a video file on the DVD that and it's not authorized as a video DVD. And if that's the case, you just double click on your DVD and then double click on the file. If there's a video TS file a folder, then that's
That's another possibility.
Video DVD.
I would definitely try VLC though. Good luck.
VLC
Video LAN Client.
Thanks,
Judith. Bye-bye.
Bye.
From Gonzales, Joanna, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Sorry if I could get through so easily. Just wanted to ask, with some help, on setting up a network between my desktop and laptop, which I've done before, and then first I had a geek come to the house and do it, and it worked right, and then it stopped working right. Then I tried to create a new one. So the mess I'm in now is that I have too many different ones. And I need to know how I would start from scratch, clean.
You're on Windows? Are both machines on Windows?
Windows 2000. XP.
There's a lot of settings you got to do this, and I think you're going to... I don't think doing it on the radio is going to really work, because you're going to have to delete some things, but maybe not. Maybe just change them. I mean, what you really should be running is DHCP, and your home router should actually handle IP address configuration and should handle all this for you automatically. If you don't have that kind of configuration, then the settings are quite complicated. And they're not so much complicated as frustrating. So all the geeks here, we all could set up our networks without what's called dynamic host...
configuration protocol.
Yeah, DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. Thanks, Miles. We could set it up without that, but it's so easy to get something that produces that. And what you do is you basically tell all the computers, be automatic, and then they plug into the network and they get assigned automatically from this router things that will allow them to talk to each other. So that's really what you're aiming for. And I don't know, having a geek come out would be fine. Also, just going to your local computer store. If you got a small shop computer store in Gonzales, go ahead and go there and ask them, hey, I just need a home router. This is what I've got. I've got a DSL, whatever. The other thing is, if you've got DSL or cable, you can actually buy a new box from them, which will have wireless but also have the newest configuration, and then you can follow their instructions. Probably cost you about $100. And if you go to the store, it's probably going to cost about $50, but it'll probably be more configuration, a little bit more questions. That's, I think, what we can do for you on air, Joanna.
All right, so wrapping that up, I do have DSL. So are you suggesting the first thing you would do is call whoever you're buying your DSL from and ask them first?
If you've got a local DSL provider, definitely. If you've got one of those big ones like AT&T, SBC Global thing.
I do.
It's a little bit more frustrating with them, but what you kind of want to do is take a look at the modem itself. There's a few different ways the modem can be configured, but if you deal with the modem and there's one port on the back that looks like a wide phone cable that goes to your computer, that's just a modem. If there's like four of those ports, that's a modem and router. The And if it's just one port, it means you got a pretty old one, and you probably want to just get a new one from AT&T. And if you get a new one from AT&T, it's going to have multiple ports on it. You plug everything into that. It'll even have wireless for the laptop. That's the way to go, in my opinion. Thank you very much, Joanne.
One last thing. My laptop is wireless.
Yeah, well, so it helps the process along if you've got it all in one box as wireless. But good luck, Joanne.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. I guess Elizabeth from Aptos sent us a note that said the Obama Weekly radio address is already on YouTube. It's already up there.
That's great.
Interesting. Very cool.
Let's do another story real quick.
Yeah, go for it.
So this is sad news, but the Mars Phoenix lander, I guess they can't get in touch with it anymore.
Yeah. I heard you guys talking about this before the show, and I get that it's kind of sad that this went under, but it did last longer than it was planning on.
Way longer.
Right.
Yeah, longer, yeah.
And it was landing on, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, it's landing close to the North Pole, and it's going into a winter zone now where there's not going to be enough light, and its batteries were never designed to go to the temperatures that the North Pole will get. So really, it was always planned to die around this time.
CO2 ice will be forming on this.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets cold.
Right.
It gets
cold. I guess the battery itself, the chemical reaction.
It covers up the
crack.
Solar.
Yeah, like some chemicals.
The solar cells, they just can't take enough energy in.
Right.
There's too much dust, and it's not
But this thing was really
sunlight.
Successful, right? This thing found water in different levels. It dug a lot of soil. Tons of data got sent back, right. And they're still analyzing it.
But on the bright side, the spirit.
I saw what you did there, the bright side. Go on.
the spirit lander where they were having some trouble getting information back from, because Mars is actually ending up in a colder than normal, the coldest it's ever been so far. They actually got a response back from it. They said, contact us back at this time, and Spirit did.
Right. But
so the spirit lander is still
Spirit's in part of the planet that actually gets sun. So
right, but I mean that. But they were worried that that was going to be a loss as well,
right?
And that's actually kind of
it might survive. Have enough heating and light.
So what's next? Next year, NASA is slated to launch an SUV-sized rover on a trip to Mars. Budget $2 billion. It will carry three different kinds of cameras, as well as chemistry instruments, environmental sensors, and radiation monitors. And its goal is to look for any sign of life that's ever existed.
Do you know how long it will be?
And to prepare the planet for human arrival.
No, it's not.
Oh.
Well, it's got an SUV there, so Americans can go.
Okay. We just got to bring our gas.
Very nice.
Something I do wonder, why a rover wouldn't have like a nuclear fuel cell to it. Because it gets so cold, if you have something that's hot and you have something that's very cold and two services, you have electricity.
We should get somebody from, one of the labs to come on the show, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We should get someone on, come on and talk about that.
Sounds great to me.
That would be really interesting.
Hey,
that's how the Voyager probes went. You had something, heat source, and then a cold being in space, and that's how they're powered.
From hot Sulphur Springs, Colorado, Kevin, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Pretty good. What's up?
Yeah, I was listening to your caller, Mike, about his Ubuntu problem.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, I wasn't quite following, but did he try hitting the escape button to get into his grub menu? Because on my installation, you know, I've got about 1 or 2 seconds.
Right, it's the escape, and then 1, 2, 3, and then it starts booting.
So,
right?
Mike, here's the thing. When you see grub up on the screen, push escape, and it will probably stop the grub auto launch to Ubuntu.
It will stop.
So Kevin, you agree with me and Miles that it seems really unlikely that Ubuntu would erase his data on the Windows partition?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to do it purposely. I don't see, I've been playing with Ubuntu for a couple years, and I don't see how you could do it.
The last thing they need is people thinking that it's going to erase their data.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're going to see that Mike's going to have a lot better experience than we thought. He just hasn't found the menu item, which is an escape button, which is a little strange. Is there a way to modify grub settings from within Linux, from within Ubuntu?
Oh, yeah. You
What's
can,
this thing?
I'm not... you can go into, I've got to think, but it's there's a configuration in your boot menu.
Yeah.
So you can get like 10 seconds
right.
to change into grub. And I know there's a default way so that your grub screen comes
Miles,
up.
Right. It's actually /boot/grub menu.lst.
Yeah, that's great. The menu list inside grub, inside boot, that's fine. But that's all command line stuff. Is there like something in Ubuntu where you can say boot up options
seems
and choose?
I've seen that before, but right, I don't.
That's a homework assignment for you, Miles.
when you turn on your computer, put a paperweight on the escape key.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm just looking, you know, because, I mean, I just run Ubuntu. I don't use...
You don't use the other stuff, so you want it to boot up quick. Yeah.
Well, hey, yeah, and I don't use Windows or
Kevin,
anything.
Kevin, thank you so much. How did you hear about GeekSpeak?
I can't remember.
Okay.
Right. To be honest with you, but I listen to you on the internet, obviously.
Obviously, from
Colorado. All right, hey. Definitely. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kevin. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Let's go to Live Oak, unless there's another news story.
I have one.
Okay.
Okay, cool. So the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention typically tracks influenza and, you know, with doctor reports and everything, and figures out, you know, how many people have influenza and or flu. But as it turns out, Google Trends, which is a technology that Google released a while back, which allows you to type in a search query.
It's a login analysis tool.
And, yeah, it shows you how many people have searched over a timeline graph. Well, it turns out that they found that there's a correlation between certain flu-related search queries. Mm-hmm. You know,
and like, times of year.
And times of year. And they've actually correlated Google Trends on certain terms with the CDC data, which is the Center for Disease.
Very cool.
Yeah, and it's really neat because actually Google Flu Trends is about 1 to 2 weeks consistently ahead of CDC, and it's very accurate. It's relatively accurate.
And we're about to hit a really bad spot.
Yeah, it's true. Well, it's December. December's coming up.
It really spikes.
For flu.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they've got like 4 years or something, whatever Google Trends is, years of data.
Yeah, it all kind of overlaps.
Web log analysis is a pretty interesting way to look at how our society thinks and acts, and I think it's neat that you're seeing disease issues coming up on Google.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for that news story. Let's try to get one more news story in today. Let's go to Live Oak. Steve, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, Lyle. It's Steve.
Hi, Steve.
Old buddy. I can give you a news article that geeks would be interested in. The premiere of Doctor Who Season 4 will be on tonight on BBC America on cable.
Okay.
Really cool.
And also, before I get to I have a question about Windows Media Player. One of you guys had a beautiful statement about that next NASA project was going to prepare Mars for human arrival.
Yeah, I love that. That's what it said in the story.
That statement boggles the mind. It could be like, are they going to put in a small Starbucks or something?
Right.
They'll drop off in cardboard boxes.
Well, the probe is the size of an SUV, so that's preparation. That's all you need.
Exactly. There'll be an SUV there. Next thing will be a gas pump.
Yep.
Okay. My question has to do with my Vista laptop. All of a sudden, Windows Media Player won't play, and if it won't open. And if I try to open a Windows Media file, you know, a .wmv file, I get the hourglass for a couple of seconds, and that's it. What could cause something like that?
Wow. So when you open a WMV file,
it won't open.
It's just not opening. Where did you get the file from?
There are various. Well, I have WMV files from various places.
And you've played them before?
Yeah, oh, yes, and they've played before.
So it sounds to me like the codec is not being found. Or something else is stomped on the codec that Windows Media Player uses.
But Media Player won't start. Sounds like there's actually a library issue that
Have you tried?
Even if I go to the application, it does the same thing.
So
nothing happens.
I get the hourglass for just a second or two, and then nothing.
So basically, Windows Media Player is not launching is the biggest problem.
That's
Is there a way to uninstall and reinstall Windows Media Player?
Which version are you using? Do you know if you have 10 or 11?
I can tell you in 1 second.
You can actually go to Microsoft.com and download 11. And you might want to try installing that or reinstalling.
Yeah, I would download 11 and try to run the install on it and see how it goes.
That sounds like a good solution.
Let me see if I can find the link and put it up.
In any case. Okay.
Yeah, the biggest problem with downloading software from Microsoft is trying to get to the right thing because the site is so friggin' complicated. And, of course, sometimes they'll try to do the general advantage thing where they're trying to detect what you've got, and you don't really want that because they're going to say, you don't need Media 11 because you already have it. But in reality, you need to force it to download. So Sean's going to throw up the URL for that up on the site.
Yeah, you can download it. It's 25 megs. We'll put the link up. And make sure you grab the right version for 32-bit or 64-bit. There's different versions.
You probably have 32-bit for a laptop.
I do.
All right. Steve, thanks for the call.
Okay, Lyle. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we could possibly get one more question there. I think not.
I've got a really, really quick news story. It's just really quick. It's a video that I want to show you guys. It's this.
We're on the radio, Ben.
No. It's online as well. I posted the link. And it's basically a blimp which looks like a giant whale.
And it's flying by flapping
its tail.
And its
fins are attached to servo motors, and its tail actually waves back and forth. So it looks like it's swimming
in the
through
air.
Water.
And it's in a mall. It looks like it's in a mall.
Yeah, and like when it's just so cool. I just can't get over how cool that looks.
It is swimming. It's going through a fluid.
Oh, I
the fluid is
so.
Air instead of water.
You're so smart, Miles.
So,
you're going to college.
So all of you guys should go to geekspeak.org and take a look at this video.
Did you make it live?
It's just so cool. Oh, I didn't make it live,
I feel the stress happening right now.
But yeah, apparently it's called the finfish. and this is in this is from someone I think in Switzerland, and it's from it was shown in Germany and whatever. It's just really, really cool.
Very cool.
And then to slow itself down at the end, it like shudders. I don't know. Okay, you guys got to check it out.
GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Complete Mailing Service. Direct mailing is what they do. Complete Mailing Service at 425-5556. Get a glimpse of life on the street on the 7th Avenue Project Sunday at noon on Central Coast Public Radio KOSP. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks this morning were Sean Cleveland. He's the Senior Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be in here.
Miles Elam. He's back at school doing literature to become a English teacher. Miles Elam.
Always a pleasure.
We also have Ben Jaffe, who turned 14 today. Ben, happy birthday.
13.
Okay. happy birthday, Ben. And you can start drinking now, right?
Yeah.
Ben Jaffe's a media dude. He made a great behind-the-scenes video. If you're curious about what the geeks look like when we sit behind the board, what KOSP from the studio looks like, go up to geekspeak.org. Today's show, which is, of course, Saturday, November 15th, 2008. I'm Lyle Troxell for KOSP and for GeekSpeak.